It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Say hello to Jim Barrier.
Well, that was a quick introduction. Hi, Bob.
Well, we want to give you as much time to talk as we can.
Well, I've warned you, it's going to take 2 weeks, so we're going to do part one tonight and part two next week, God willing, and all of the rest. So. So what I wanted to talk about tonight, we've done a lot of shows where we've talked about events of the 60s. We did a whole show about the Jesus Revolution, and you can look that up in the archives. It was a fun thing to talk about. But I grew up in the 60s. I was right in the middle of that whole thing. And I believe that there were things that took place in the 60s, ideas, events that have dramatically changed our culture, and that we are now reaping the rewards or the sanctions. John Wesley, one of my favorite characters in church history, said this: what one generation tolerates, the next generation will embrace. And I've seen that absolutely, literally happen in my lifetime, where there were things that were questionable, but we said, okay, well, we're going to let it slide. And now they are mainstream and accepted, and in fact, in some cases, expected. And so I want to talk about some of those things. And I need to clarify this, because some of the things I'm going to say, someone may be listening and saying, well, that didn't start in the 60s. And that's true. There's hardly anything that's new under the sun. But there were things that became common beliefs or practices in the 60s that prior to that were fringe.
You mean like ideas that were for the circus tent once are commonplace in the classroom now?
Yes, exactly. So I'm going to start with a little bit of philosophy, and you'll see how this plays out. And I'm going to ask you, it's going to be a little different tonight because I'm going to interview Bob.
Oh, great.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. But you've done debates, you've done so many open forums, and so I think this will be in your wheelhouse. So the first thing is what we call postmodernism. And it's kind of a confusing term, one, because most people can't define modernism outside of the fine arts. But postmodernism is a philosophical base. And this is what it is in the most simplified terms that I could put. It is that there are no absolutes.
Yeah, exactly.
What's true for you may not be true for me.
Of course, that itself is a true statement. If I say what's true for you may not be true for me, you could say, well, do you really think that what you just said is true? And if I say yes, then I just contradicted my own statement.
Yeah, and that's the problem with this type of thing. But logic flew out the window in the 60s, which I always found fascinating, Mr. Kirk, that Spock was.
Well, you know the old saying, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
Well, and I refute that. That's not true for me.
Well, the baby boomers, which is our generation, the short version of this, they got into the universities and the rest is history. I mean, they got into the universities as professors, and it made a nightmarish country for us.
Yeah, and that's what one generation tolerates, the next generation embraces. And largely through the educational system, and not just universities, but all the way down to elementary school levels now. So this concept, what's true for you may not be true for me, this was personified in the poster that was flying around during those days. It's actually a poem or a writing by a guy named Fritz Perls. And it says this, you might remember this. I do my thing and you do your thing. I am not in this world to live up to your expectations. And you are not in this world to live up to mine. You are you and I am I. And if by chance we find each other, it's beautiful. If not, it can't be helped.
Yeah, except that the people that are running our country now with that philosophy don't have that kind of tolerance because we're not allowed to disagree with them on agendas such as woke or LGBTQ. There's a list of things we darn well better lock in step with.
Yes, yes, but best be left unsaid. So I took this poster. It was a very popular poster in the 60s. I do my thing and you do your thing. And I took that poster and then I got another poster with a picture of Adolf Hitler. And I put the caption below Hitler. I do my thing and you do your thing. And I am not in this world to live up to you, blah, blah, blah. And everybody said, that's absurd. That's ludicrous. I said, exactly. Because we don't tolerate intolerance if it's a threat to our lives.
Exactly.
And Hitler was certainly one of the great villains in history. And so you can't say, well, that's what he was passionate. And so it's what he believed. And
maybe Nazism was just his truth. Who are we to judge?
Who are we to judge? Because if we do, we go to the gas chamber. That's who we are.
Yeah.
So there's hypocrisy. There's double standards. There's not a lot of honesty or logic in so much of this modern philosophy. And so this thought form manifests itself in all types of forms, in music. I won't sing it because it probably would offend somebody. But the Isley Brothers had this song, It's Your Thing, Do What You Want to Do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. I did sing it, didn't I? I couldn't help myself.
Jim Barrier sings and stumps himself.
It's happened. And here we go, my first rabbit trail. My goal, which I failed miserably at 40 years of being a pastor, my goal was to fall asleep during my own message on a Sunday morning.
I heard a story one time from somebody who said he was at a church service where the speaker actually did fall asleep during his own message. Now, that's the kind of thing you'd have to see to believe, and I can't verify it, but I did think it was pretty funny.
Well, I just thought it would be fair that I should fall asleep because half of my congregation did, and so why shouldn't I get it?
Can't I have my nap, too? Come on.
Yeah. Well, I said, you know, when I got ready to retire, I said, I've already got my plan set. My retirement is set. I'm going to sell recordings of my sermons to insomniacs. Proven commodity. But I digress. So this whole thing, moral relativity. Here are some of the mantras of our generation. If it feels good, do it. Or think for yourself. One of my favorites, question authority. I had a teacher tell me, question authority. And I said, who are you to tell me who to question?
Right.
But these became things, catchphrases, things that we recited because it felt good. So we did it. And also, it was able to justify anything that I wanted to do that maybe somebody else would say isn't appropriate. But I could say, hey, think for yourself. I'm not here to live up to your expectations. Now, we don't need a drum roll, but I'm going to launch you into a response here. But moral relativism led to the embrace of syncretism, which is all religions are basically the same. All roads lead to Rome. All religions are basically the same. I'm sure you've heard that in some of your encounters on campuses and in arenas, that all religions are basically the same. What do you say? How do you respond to that, Bob?
Well, yeah, and what they're usually saying is all religions are true. All religions are right. And my response to that is that when a person says all religions are true, what they're really saying is they believe all religions are false. And the reason I make that assessment is that if somebody said, well, all religions are true, and then I started showing them where the religions contradict. Say, well, look, they contradict themselves. They can't both be true. Get back to Aristotle's law of non-contradiction. If you have two truth claims and they contradict, they cannot both be true. They may even both be false, but at the very least, only one of them can be true. People will accept that idea if you're talking about a subject other than religion. In the context of religion, they'll say, no, that doesn't matter. What matters is that the religion is beautiful and it's helping you and you like it and you enjoy it and it comforts you. And what they're really doing is they're admitting, maybe not consciously to themselves, but they're revealing that deep inside, they are assuming all these religions are man-made belief systems that we just made up. But that's not what the different religions claim. Major world religions claim to be revelation from on high. That's a fantastic truth claim. And at a university of all places, you'd think we'd be testing truth claims. So that would be my response. That's where I would start. I'd say, when you say all religions are right, you're really saying all religions are wrong. And then I would challenge that assumption. Why are you assuming that there may not be a real God out there who's truly revealing himself with honest facts, with legitimate information?
I'm going to write that down, and I'm encouraging listeners to write this down. It isn't that all religions are true. They're saying all religions are false. That's one of the great responses I've ever heard to that notion.
And now, it's really foundational, because sometimes apologists jump right in. They try to convince people that Christianity is true to people who don't feel they need to be convinced, don't even think it's a legitimate discussion. And we've got to first challenge that assumption. Why are you assuming that religion has nothing to do with truth?
And that's a big problem. And I did a recent podcast about that whole thing about truth, that truth is knowable and it is universal, absolute, et cetera. Now, part two of this then, perhaps, and I know you've done some speaking on this, what makes true Christianity different from all these other religions? What makes Jesus different from the religious leaders? What is the difference? A few differences, probably. What is the difference in Christianity from the rest of the religions?
Well, for one thing, it's very steeped in history, and it can be verified by parallel history of the time, by archaeology, by the fulfillment of prophecy. It promises an experience where we actually encounter the Spirit of God. So we have the proof of something going through our own senses. We have the evidence of the testimony of history. Most religions don't even make those claims, let alone the fact that they'd have a hard time verifying the claim if they did make them. Jim, hold with me over the break. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Always good to be joined a couple of times a month by my good friend. Say hello again to Jim Barrier.
And on the Bob Siegel Show tonight, I'm interviewing Bob Siegel.
Always had a dream of being a guest on my own show.
See, dreams do come true, Bob. Now, this whole thing of syncretism and all religions are basically the same, that then opened the door for the 60s generation to embrace many other religions, Eastern religions in particular, and to reject the notion. This is when we started hearing a lot of talk about America is not a Christian country and the founding fathers weren't Christians, which is a lie. Most of them
Some were. Of them weren't, but most of them were, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we've talked about David Barton. He's one of my favorite writers on that subject. Just a little parenthesis here. Friday night, I went to the annual banquet for the Justice Foundation. You're familiar with these folks, and they were very, very important in the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Their keynote speaker is a guy named Bill Federer, William J. Federer. But Bill Federer, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but this guy was fantastic, and he has a lot of books out. He talked about, in particular, some of the founding fathers and people who laid the groundwork for our Constitution. And it was fascinating stuff. So look up Bill Federer, really, really well-educated and gifted speaker, writer. So we kind of rejected that whole notion that America has something to do with Christianity. And so Eastern religion became very trendy in the 60s, and it started...
Well, a lot of the hippies would claim to be into Jesus and Krishna at the same time.
At the same time, yeah. And the ones that led the way for that, it started, the Beatles' second film was called Help. And the plot was centered around an Eastern cult that was trying to recover a sacrificial ring that was stuck on Ringo's finger. And they're chasing him around the planet trying to get this ring. And in one scene, they're in a Indian restaurant. And George Harrison became fascinated with the sitar that was being used in that scene, and the sitar music, which personally, I've never been a big fan of sitar music, but it had its run in the 60s. And so he tracked down a guy named Ravi Shankar, who was the premier sitar player in India, and got him to teach him how to play this instrument. Ravi Shankar then introduced George Harrison to the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who taught transcendental meditation. And that was the door opening to pop culture and the young generation to embracing Eastern religion. And it was really a fad. It was very, very popular. Everybody was doing this. And a whole bunch of other pop stars then jumped on the bandwagon. Mike Love of the Beach Boys and Donovan. And then a number of people got into this transcendental meditation. And it became a worldwide movement to the point where the Transcendental Meditation Network has teaching centers and schools and universities and health centers all over the world, and primarily in Western world and in America. It's a big money-making thing, and people embrace this. And it's a dangerous thing. I'm going to tell you, it's a dangerous thing to empty your mind out and then allow whatever is in the cosmos to come in and fill you.
Especially since the Bible tells us what's in the cosmos, namely demons.
Yeah. Principalities in high places, spiritual wickedness. TM took off. So Eastern religion became very popular. And then along with that, people started exploring things. And so Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, you see the little symbol. Perhaps it's a black and white symbol with two little curls that match together. And it's this notion that there's dualism, but everything is one. And people just started marrying all of these different thought forms. And now we have a generation where many, many people, even people in the church, I've talked to people in the church that profess to be Christians that believe in reincarnation in some form.
Yeah, and this is because the church does not do a good job of discipling its people.
Absolutely. And I used to hit stuff like that pretty heavy from the pulpit and just challenge it and say, here's what's wrong with saying things like, here's what's wrong with embracing that lie. And I know you have the same foundation I do. If it's not in the scriptures, you're in dangerous ground. And if the scripture can't support a concept, if it doesn't teach it, if it's not consistently throughout the Bible, I'm inclined to reject it or at least be suspect, be very suspicious of it. But all of these things just throughout the Bible, and that goes back to the postmodern thing that there's no absolute. So the Bible, some of it's good, but not all of it's good. And we kind of pick and choose. It's like a smorgasbord.
Yeah, the part that isn't good, coincidentally, is the part that I don't like that challenges my life.
Always, always. You have a story. I've told this to me a couple of times, but you were doing, I think, an open forum thing, and a young man was challenging, and he said, well, I can accept Buddha, but not Jesus, or something, or Muhammad, or whatever, but not Jesus. And you said, and why is Jesus a problem? Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was actually regarding the philosophers. He was trying to challenge the fact that our New Testament manuscripts were copies and not the originals. And I said, well, they come to within 200, 300 years. And I said, you start looking at philosophers like Aristotle, we have a 1,400-year gap. So do you have trouble believing in Aristotle? And he said, well, Aristotle doesn't challenge the way I live my life. And so he was very honest about that.
And, you know, I run into very few people that are that honest.
Yeah, I actually commended the guy for his honesty because a lot of people wouldn't have admitted that.
Yeah, and the truth is that permeates everything in the postmodern thinking and in evolutionist viewpoint in many of the hot topics today. And it's that they don't want to open the door to a all-knowing, all-powerful, personal, infinite God, because I would have to be subject to such a being, and I would have to consider his wisdom and his direction in how I should live. That's where people draw the line. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I want.
Yeah, that's really the bottom line. People act like it's an academic barrier, but it's really a moral barrier.
It absolutely is.
There are people that ask sincere academic questions, but then when they get a sincere answer, they open themselves up to it, or at least they may not be immediately bowled over, but they at least consider it. But you also have the disingenuous who do not really want to hear an answer, and they're very disappointed if they hear it, because now they're without excuse.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges is to get a person to be honest. If you're trying to present the gospel and present Jesus Christ as God's means for salvation and atonement, you have to get people to be honest. And then it gets deep because they have to be honest about themselves. And there is the element of repentance in the gospel. And if you're not honest about your own sin, then it's very hard to repent of it if you don't think that you're guilty of something, or if you at least won't admit it. So that's kind of where we have wound up now as far as philosophy and religion. And then right on the heels of that, the 60s brought the sexual revolution. Free love, make love, not war.
Yeah, when you told me about a poster that you were about to quote, I thought you were going to say that one. I was thinking of the make love, not war.
Well, that was very popular.
Like, if we could all just get together, just join hands, you know, and sing kumbaya, then there'd be no more war, man.
Well, and when people would spout that stuff, it was very shallow, because first of all, most people can't define the word love in any biblical sense.
Or understand that any freedom they have is the result of wars.
Yeah. And that's the second part. They don't understand war, and I am not in favor of war. I think war is horrible, the devastation it brings. But
our country was founded based on a war. And slavery was freed in our country because of a war. So there are times when I agree, most wars are over oil and land, and most wars are not good wars. But occasionally, we've had some just ones.
Well, and, you know, when Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, what are we going to do? Say, well, we're not into it.
Could send them a bouquet of flowers and hope they don't bomb us again next month.
Yeah, peace and love. So that whole thing about make love, not war. One, they don't understand what real love is, because for most people, love is an emotional thing. And in that context of that saying, that poster and everything, make love, they're really talking about a sexual expression.
Yeah, and the word peace doesn't mean anything, really. Hitler claimed he was about peace. You go and look at the early speeches of Hitler and the negotiations where they gave him back everything he wanted. You do this and we'll have peace. Okay, speaking of peace, we're going to have a piece of a sponsor right now. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric, Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Bob Siegel's novels may start out looking like typical stories, but in no time at all, they go directions you would never have dreamed about. Just listen to the premise of Bob Siegel's unusual story, Choice of the Lorelei. Martha Flannery, an aggressive missionary, sets out for the Frisian Islands to convert the newly discovered tribe called Reinu. Here she enters into a strong battle of wills with Dr. Connors, a cultural anthropologist who wants to protect the Reinu people from outside influence, especially evangelism. Connor's strange manners and obsession with the Reinu are only the first of several eerie mysteries, including previous visitors to the island who never returned home and an elderly gentleman claiming to be 4,000 years old. Choice of the Lorelei, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show, the only radio show in history that offers you a show within a show. That's right. It's time for another episode of Stump Jim Barrier.
Well, in the words of the great Edwin Starr, war, what is it good for? Absolutely.
Absolutely nothing.
Just wanted to point that.
No, I can't hear that song without seeing Jackie Chan in my mind.
Yeah, with Rush Hour, all that. Yeah, that was a really good song.
Well, in the case of that composer, war was good for him getting some royalties on his music, at least.
Yeah, there you go.
It worked for him.
There you go.
And I was kind of surprised to know that that was one of the songs that during the 9/11 attacks that was gone from radio. You couldn't play that song specifically.
Oh, I had not heard that. I don't believe in censorship. Yeah. I do believe we should have responded to 9/11, but not with crazy censorship.
I gotcha. So for today, we are going to go to the year 1977 for this one. And we're going to be celebrating another famous San Diegan. He got his start here in San Diego. So let's see if he can get this artist. This is a soft rock song, so it's kind of slow, but we're going to see if he can get it. Here we go.
Soft rock.
Down in Jamaica, they got lots of pretty women. Steal your money, then they break your heart.
Speaking of falling asleep during sermons, I could always fall asleep during this song.
Is that a San Diego artist originally?
That is correct.
Stephen Bishop?
That's right. And what song?
On and On.
That's
right?
Correct. That's correct.
And it goes on and on and on.
You guys got that.
Not one of my favorites, but yes, music's a matter of taste. So I know?
I like the fact that he was from San Diego, and we're just giving some representation. That's about it, honestly.
I'm not going to give that much license to music just because somebody happens to be from San Diego. He's got to write a good song, too.
That's true.
Well, it's a good song, and I think submitted another song for the old KGB Homegrown album series.
Ooh, how about that?
Well, that sounds like you could grow something homegrown in a field before that song's even over.
Oh, okay. Listen, Bob, we all have our personal
It's a
taste.
Matter of taste. I admitted that. I fully admit
you
that.
You do your thing, and I do mine.
You do your thing, and I'll do mine, but I'm completely intolerant of your intolerance of my tolerance.
And I'm not in this world to listen to your music.
That's right. And if we could all just join hands and not judge each other's music, what a wonderful world it would be.
Yeah, okay. Well, that was fun.
Thank you, thank you. So besides that, the only thing I was going to mention was that's how I feel about Biden's speeches. They just seem to go on and on. On and on. That's
no
about
kidding.
It.
Yeah. Oh my. You know. And by the way, this segment is my wife's favorite part of the show. So I don't. Because she always wants to see if he can stump me. He's been pretty good about keeping somewhat in my wheelhouse, 60s and 70s. And I honestly thought tonight, since we're talking about the 60s, that you're going to pull something out of the 60s. But you threw me a curve.
Well, he didn't know ahead of time what we were going to talk about. In his defense, he just knew you were coming on. So
okay. Well, next week, we're talking about the 60s.
Okay, Brendan, you right, got hint, your hint. Cues.
Yes, I got the elbow nudges. Okay.
Oh, boy. Now, talking about the sexual revolution, what this is it was really legitimizing sex outside of a monogamous heterosexual relationship, that is, marriage. And so it brought about the normalization. And again, as I said at the top of the show, it wasn't the invention of any of these things, but it was the normalization of it. It was the embrace of it. And so contraception became the norm, primarily the pill. And so you could go have sex with somebody and not worry about getting pregnant.
And we should say contraception within marriage, there's nothing wrong with that. We're not saying that you can't use contraception. Right. But when it was used as a license and a freedom to go out and do something that the Bible forbids, that's another story.
That was a big problem with that. And then public nudity became more common. Nude beaches and topless events and pornography just skyrocketed. And
Jim, that stuff must have been important because during the great lockdown, churches were viewed as non-essential services and strip bars were allowed to stay open. So they must have been onto something.
Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody who was making the rules liked to frequent those establishments.
I hadn't thought of that, but it's certainly possible.
Okay. And the Lolita Express. Okay. And then in popular novels and films, overt sexuality became very common, and we started having film ratings, and you had to really do something graphic to get an R rating as far as sex. Premarital sex became very accepted. Homosexuality started to kick in the door, and subsequently the legalization of abortion because of all the promiscuity and people.
And we should say that the legalization of abortion was sold 100% under the phrase contraception, and nobody even wanted to have a discussion about whether the unborn baby was alive. So if you were against abortion, you were against contraception. That's still the way they try to sell it. And they're just hoping people will be too dumb to discern the difference.
Yeah. One of the phrases that just flips my boat, I just made up a saying, is when they talk about women's reproductive rights. No, they don't want to reproduce. That's the whole point of abortion. By the way, I
believe in women's rights. I just believe they extend to baby women as well.
Exactly. And by the way, this thought occurred to me, and I said something to somebody on Facebook about it, but when they opened the door to abortion by saying it's tissue and started using the word fetus and not a baby. And when they
even though the word fetus means baby anyway.
Yeah. But when they dehumanized an unborn human, that set in motion the things that lead now to the rhetoric. There's no male. There's no female. If there's no humanness, then the next logical thing is, well, you're not necessarily male or female.
Well, and what's scary is that's what legitimized slavery, too. They tried to portray the African-American slaves as not being as human as everybody else, because the moment they admitted they were completely human, they were admitting that they had human rights.
Yes, and of course, the Nazis were famous for doing that.
The Jews were subhuman to the Nazis.
Yeah, anyone who was handicapped. All kinds of people were subhuman, and therefore they didn't deserve to live. And gosh, that couldn't happen in our country, could it?
Yeah, living in Germany, being blonde-haired and blue-eyed was better than a passport.
Yeah. So we had that whole thing happen, and we have not recovered. In fact, it just spiraled out of control. Now, one of the significant things, you know, I mentioned Hugh Hefner, and I think he's one of the worst influences on our culture in history and how he made pornography acceptable. But Cosmopolitan magazine was established in 1886 as a family magazine. But in 1965, Helen Gurley Brown, you remember her, a devout feminist, took over as the chief editor. And she changed it into a quote-unquote women's magazine with racy, contentious, sometimes offensive. In fact, for a while, Kroger supermarkets put brown paper bags on Cosmopolitan.
Isn't that the one that Burt Reynolds became infamous for posing nude for? Wasn't that Cosmopolitan?
It's such a joke because, for one thing, if men make women sexual objects, it's wrong. So why isn't it wrong if women make sexual objects? It's such a hypocrisy.
And kind of an irony for somebody with the name Girly.
I thought of that, too. I wasn't going to say it, but thank you for pointing, making the obvious obvious.
Whole new definition to the term girly man.
Yeah. Oh, Arnold is offended. So
he's just a girly man.
But the truth is it did a lot of damage. And, you know, I go through the supermarket, and the magazine's always right there at the cash register. And every month, it seems like, they've got an article in Cosmopolitan about 50 new ways to please your lover. And I'm thinking, come on, you can't do that 12 times a year. There's not that many techniques. I have an imagination, but I can't.
Yeah, and even Paul Simon only knew 50 ways to leave your lover.
Leave your lover. That might be true. But all of this stuff, and we're making light of something, it's a very serious subject, because the sexual revolution is directly responsible for what we now deal with child abuse, human trafficking, gender confusion.
Well, and in our elementary schools, we now have institutionalized child abuse.
Yes. And
with these surgeries that they want to approve without even giving the parents any kind of notice, there are places where they're trying to do that.
And that needs to be stopped. One of my friends that I saw at the banquet the other night, I talked about him, Mark DeRazio, who is a freshman representative here in the state of Texas. He is one of the primary people pushing the parent school rights bills so that parents can choose where their kids will be educated and get the same benefits and credits that people do in public schools.
And there was a time when people believed parents had that right instead of labeling them as terrorists for doing so. Okay, Jim, hold with me for one more segment. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
The sequel to The Dangerous Christmas Ornament is called Inside the Castle in the Glass, and already this entertaining sequel is getting great reviews from customers on Amazon.com. Reviews such as this one. Very clever way of introducing certain life principles in a fictional setting. I thoroughly enjoyed the story. Here's another review. I picked up this book at a book signing with Bob Siegel on a Friday. By Monday morning before work, I finished it. This is over 500 pages of story. I couldn't put it down. I would plan to put it down at the end of the chapter, then something big would take place. I would have to continue to see what happened. A lot of unexpected twists and turns and a lot of things you can't imagine. Things that make you say, "What?" By the way, I am pushing 60 years old and I enjoyed this book and look forward to more of Bob's books. Keep them coming. Inside the Castle in the Glass, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Yeah. beautiful music of Celtic Woman and the beautiful song Scarborough Fair, made famous in The Graduate. Beautiful song. Say hello again to Jim Barrier.
And concerning that song, and Brad, that I know you're listening, it's very hard to find, but if you could track down a recording of that tune by a man named Harold McNair, who was a flute player back during those days, and he played for Donovan and a number of different artists, but he did an album called The Fence, and it was all instrumentals, and he did a number of pop tunes, and his interpretation of Scarborough Fair is really, really good. Okay.
And I believe it was actually originally an old English ballad. Is that not true, Jim?
Yeah, I think lyrically it probably is inspired by that. And of course, it had two titles. It was originally Scarborough Fair and Canticle.
That's the version that Simon and Garfunkel did, yes.
Yeah.
They superimposed it over a song singing against the Vietnam War.
Yeah, so they changed it to Scarborough Fair and Canton.
Right.
Another very trivial stuff here, but you keep having me on your show. I'm going to keep doing this. Now, earlier in the show, you quipped, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. And I think Robin Williams popularized that phrase. But I'm going to tell you, I remember the 60s, and I was there. But the reason I remember it was I didn't do drugs. I was one of the few people in my circle who didn't use drugs. And that's our next segment.
Right, and that statement, of course, was referring to those who used drugs.
Yeah, yeah. But I did not. And so I'd go to these concerts and hear these groups, and I'd say, that they were terrible. And everybody said, no, man, it was great. You were stoned. So drug use really became popular during that time. And just like the things we talked about, Eastern religion and sexuality, those were not new, but they became acceptable. And again, I'm going to have to give blame to one of my favorite groups, the Beatles. They really made drug use okay because they were cool. And if the Beatles did drugs, they're cool. Well, I could be cool too. I remember in 1 year's time, people that I knew who smoked marijuana were outcasts. They called them junkies. They were rejected by the popular people.
And now it's legalized.
In 1 year's time, you were not cool if you didn't smoke pot. And now, yes, now it's legal. I didn't have any need to. I didn't have any desire to. It was like, what do you need that? I don't want to be out of control of my senses. And it seemed that when I saw friends of mine who really got stoned, they were not in control of their senses. So it didn't have an appeal to me, legal or otherwise. But illicit drugs, marijuana, LSD, then became very popular. And again, because the Beatles dropped acid, so, oh, it must be cool. And cocaine, which has been around forever, cocaine became, for people that could afford it, a cool drug to take at parties and stuff. And it was, before then, it was used by the fringes of society, social rejects, and then in the 60s, all of that became very hip to do these things, and it became recreational. I love that, recreational drugs, and it became socially acceptable. So much like alcohol and tobacco, it became a common thing. So that has really, really paid dividends for evil in our culture. Remember Timothy Leary? Tune in, turn on,
drop out.
Yeah, and that's what happened. People, they dropped out.
I remember Mad Magazine had a cover that said, tune in, turn on, throw up. Kind of love Mad Magazine.
I love Mad Magazine. So and most of the original writers and artists from that publication have passed away, but I grew up reading that stuff, and that explains a lot. Who needs drugs? I read Mad Magazine and watched Twilight Zone. I didn't.
Yeah, who needs drugs when you have that?
Now, at the same time, when you had all of this stuff with the drugs being sold illegally and people using these things, prescription drugs began to increase. In 1929, the revenue from prescription drugs was about 32% of all of the drugs, over-the-counter varieties included, in 1929, and in 1969, it was 83% of the revenue, and it just shot up. Valium, which came out in 1963, became the first $100 million drug, and then later on became the first $1 billion drug. And of course, you had to have a prescription for that, but the abuse of chemical prescriptions that were supposed to be for medication, etc., that became a huge problem. I have a dear friend who lives in Colorado, and she works for the DEA. And she doesn't go down to fight the cartel or border check. Her whole job is checking on prescription drug abuse. Doctors who are distributing drugs illegally, people who get prescription drugs illicitly and use those things because they're addicted to them. And so you have the combination of the recreational drugs, the psychedelics and those things, and now you have prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs becoming a huge epidemic. And here's how that's affected where we are today. The influx of illegal drugs into this country, the war with the cartels, and all of the people, I think we would be shocked if we knew some of the people who were part of that process and turning a blind eye so they could get their pockets lined and allowing those drugs to come into this country, not to mention just the whole open border crisis that allows these things to come in. Now we have what we call an opioid crisis. People are addicted and it produces overdoses and brain damage and destroys families. Drug-related crime. You know, a lot of people get addicted and they can't afford the high price of their drug of choice. And so they have to find ways to raise funds. So they rob people. They hold up a store. They pimp themselves out as prostitutes. I had a friend, he went from law enforcement, then he became a private investigator. And he told me this term that there are prostitutes in San Diego working the streets and they call them strawberries because they will sell themselves for a dose of drugs. They skip the money part and just say, give me my fix and you can do whatever you want.
Okay, Jim, we are out of time in just a few seconds. Oh. What can we expect next week on the continuation of this talk?
Next week, we're going to talk about economical, technological, and political things that took place in the 60s. So there you go.
All right. Well, we will look forward to that. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious. We will see you next time.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.